funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of seeking out fair trade products in our globalized economy? And what motivates us to look for these items in a marketplace crowded with many different choices regarding ethical and sustainable production, quality, aesthetics, and price? As many as 8 in 10 Americans say they would be willing to pay more for items produced under good working conditions. But as my guest today has discovered, applying those benevolent intentions to actions in a crowded marketplace involves a fairly complicated set of choices and values. Keith R. Brown has studied all this in his work as assistant professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He shares what he has learned in his new book, Buying Into Fair Trade, Culture, Morality, and Consumption. Keith, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is fair trade, and who gets to define the term?
Two great and not easy to answer questions. To reduce the idea of fair trade into something that we can understand, it's supposed to be a system that when you buy products, the people who produce the products, often living in developing countries, receive a social, economic, and environmental premium for producing those products. So, for example, with coffee, coffee farmers who produce fair trade coffee receive about $1.30 to $1.40 a pound, and that's guaranteed. So if the price of coffee is less than that, they're still guaranteed that $1.30 to $1.40 a pound. And in terms of social premiums, this may mean things like a community might get funds for women to start up a marketplace to sell handicrafts, or they might be given small loans to develop a local business. The communities themselves are supposed to be able to decide how that money is spent. So the problem with defining fair trade is there's so many different people at play in this movement. There's people who view fair trade as something where farmers should receive, coffee farmers, for example. I keep going to coffee farmers because they comprise the biggest part of the fair trade marketplace. That they believe that farmers should receive a significant amount of money, whereas sometimes more profit-driven companies will argue that we should help a wider range of people and maybe not give them as much money. So defining exactly what fair trade means is not a simple, there's no simple catchphrase. I guess the easiest way to define fair trade is to think of it as a social movement instead of a market. And by doing that, there's space for, you know, the activists and the big corporations that are selling fair trade products.
It's interesting that coffee has such a large share of the fair trade market. Is there something special about coffee that drives us to think more about how it's produced than, say, imported mangoes or T-shirts or computers?
Yeah, one of the, I think, seductive parts of coffee is that it is the second most traded commodity next to oil in the world, and we often don't think of that, but as coffee is something that's so powerful in the global marketplace, but it is. So I think that's one aspect of the story. The second is in the 80s in the United States, a number of different importers began trying to express solidarity with coffee farmers in Nicaragua. In the 80s, there was a boycott against goods coming in from Nicaragua. So Equal Exchange, which is located up in Boston, began importing coffee into Canada and Holland, and they roasted it there. And by roasting it there, they were able to get around this loophole and then import the coffee into the United States. So this created kind of, this is one of the first products to come in with fair trade certification. So I think that in itself, having a slightly longer history than almost all the other products, helps explain why coffee's dominating this marketplace.
Okay, you mentioned certification. What is that process? And you go through in the book the fact that there are multiple organizations that sort of want to spearhead this.
Right, and this is, again, where fair trade gets a little bit sometimes more difficult than it should be to understand. In the United States, there's an organization called, it's now called Fairtrade USA, and that organization certifies products as opposed to organizations as being produced fairly. Many other countries have similar organizations, and there's a kind of umbrella organization called the Fair Trade Labeling Organization, which sets standards globally for all these national organizations. There is a bit of a conflict now between Fair Trade USA and the Fair Trade Labeling Organization, but almost all other countries are part of FLO, this Fair Trade Labeling Organization, the bigger umbrella organization. I know that's a little bit tricky to understand. The value of both of these organizations is that they're not affiliated with any individual company, so they independently certify that products are produced fairly. And again, what fairly exactly means can vary by product and does vary by product.
There's also some interesting debate as to whether these organizations should work with large corporations and manufacturers who have violated what we would consider to be fair trade standards in the past, or whether those organizations should be sort of shut out of this kind of certification.
Yep. And this is, we're seeing this tension manifest itself now very strongly in the fair trade movement. If you take a longer view of the history of fair trade, you'll see a number of church members in the United States came out of the Mennonite Church. A woman named Edna Ruth Byler began importing handicrafts from around the world, starting in Puerto Rico, because she wanted to help the poor living conditions of the artisans producing these handicrafts. And many of the people, and that organization later became 10,000 Villages, which is one of the largest fair trade organizations in the world, selling handicrafts. Many people who enter this fair trade market started with that mission-driven goal of, I want to help fair trade artisans or farmers. On the other hand, once that they created a niche and this idea of fair trade began to catch on, more profit-oriented companies saw this as a way to create value in a crowded marketplace. So we can, you know, distinguish our coffee from the competitors by saying ours is socially responsible. And because of that, you get this tension between this mission-driven wing of the movement and this more profit-oriented wing of the movement. And it is it's an ongoing struggle between these factions They're fighting over what exactly fair trade means and what direction the future of this movement should go.
And, you know, for some people, it might be easy to get their hackles up about the profit motive. But if you want this to remain economically sustainable, people have to be making some money along the way.
Yeah, very much so. And in my research, I studied a guy named Joe Chasa, which he opened one of the first fair trade coffee shops in Philadelphia. And you know, Joe said, I got into this movement because, you know, I wanted to make a difference in the world, but I also, you know, I wanted to retire one day and I want to be profitable. Joe's story became interesting because his coffee shop, for a variety of reasons, failed economically. He was losing money. He never met the goals of his business plan. Yet he remained open for 8 years. While he, you know, he lost all the value in his home, he lost all his retirement funds, he went bankrupt. And the question is, why would Joe continue doing this? Well, Joe continued to do it because he kept meeting the coffee farmers who sold his products. He traveled to meet them in Puerto Rico and Nicaragua, and he really believed he was helping that change the world and, you know, providing some health care benefits for these farmers. And so this seemingly non-rational set of decisions makes more sense when you understand, you know, that Joe's identity as a social activist. Joe struggled to remain profitable, but you are seeing this movement grow very rapidly in the U.S., and many, companies are finding sustainable ways to make fair trade happen.
All right, you identify three different kinds of buyers in the book. There are purchasers, there are conscientious consumers, and there are promoters. Tell us about the differences between them.
Sure. The first, these purchasers are people who maybe didn't even know they were buying a fair trade product. They wanted coffee, and their local coffee shops sold fair trade coffee, so they made the purchase. So they end up not being a major focus of the book, but it's important to make that distinction. Conscientious consumers and promoters both care greatly about fair trade, and they say, I want to, you know, change the world through my purchases. The difference is promoters really cling to that value system. And they're a very, you know, my work is ethnographic. In other words, I can't make large generalizations based on my sample size because I studied a very specific location in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But based on some other survey research, I would guess promoters are somewhere between 3 to 7% of the population. And these individuals not just care about fair trade, but they have fewer contradictions in their purchasing patterns. In other words, they say they support fair trade, and they'll walk the extra block for fair trade coffee. They'll only buy sweatshop-free clothing and organic foods grown locally. And they have a much more rigid alliance between their ideals and their purchasing patterns.
Mm-hmm.
These people tend to have traveled internationally and oftentimes to developing countries to see the hardships that many farmers or artisans are living under. Conscientious consumers share these same values. They view the world in a similar way as promoters, but they have many more contradictions between their values and their everyday purchases. So they say things like, I hate Walmart. Walmart, aren't they the worst? But last week when I had to go to Walmart, I purchased X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So these comprise a very large percentage of this market. And you started the program off by saying something around 8 out of 10 consumers will say they'll pay a little extra for fair trade or socially sweatshop-free clothing or something along these lines. And that's the great majority of these individuals are conscientious consumers.
So they say they'll pay extra, but they won't necessarily go out of their way to find these items. If they happen to be right there and all things being equal, they can make the choice, they'll do it. Is that it?
Yeah, it's funny. You say all things being equal. That's almost exactly what they say. It's this idea of the fantasy of choice. They'll say things. I would hear this all the time. You know, if two products were exactly equal, you know, I would buy the fair trade one. But that situation almost never arises.
Right.
So they do that as a way to position themselves as socially conscious to kind of make sense of the fact that they often don't buy fair trade or, you know, I use fair trade to get into this bigger idea of socially conscious consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So it often led to conversations about buying local or organic foods or these types of initiatives.
My guest is Keith R. Brown. He's assistant professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. His new book is called Buying Into Fair Trade, Culture, Morality, and Consumption. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Keith R. Brown, Assistant Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University and author of the new book, Buying into Fair Trade, Culture, Morality, and Consumption. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Go back for a minute, if you would, Keith, and talk some more about Joe, because as it turns out, we have had interest in fair trade, as you mentioned, from the turn of the century when the Mennonites were interested in establishing what became 10,000 villages. But some of these trends are sort of time sensitive. Before this began to really sink in on a broad cultural level, there were people like Joe who found it sort of harder to sell fair trade goods than conventional products.
So is the question, what's making this easier today?
I suppose so. Why would people have resisted fair trade before recent years?
It's funny. That's a really important question, and a question I don't think the fair trade movement as a whole has addressed very well. Sometimes fair trade gets branded or viewed as anti-capitalist or this home for simply these liberal idealists. And the truth is, most of the people who are making these types of purchases would identify that way politically. But the movement as a whole isn't politically confrontational to capitalism. It's actually working within the capitalist system. It's not providing a very radical conflict with capitalism. So I guess what I'm getting at is this idea of fair trade being home for, you know, people who wear Birkenstocks and this type of stereotype. There is some truth to that, but politically, the movement itself doesn't align itself with that, and I don't think leaders have addressed that problem. So in order to help more people, you've got to attract more people to fair trade products, more consumers, and I think they need to do a better job of this is a struggle when you move from a niche market, a product sold outside of churches or synagogues, to a mainstream market where you can find fair trade products at Starbucks or Walmart. So this is a struggle with the movement. It's interesting to see how people's meanings of fair trade are changing as it becomes more mainstream.
Has the movement dealt with the sometimes uncomfortable reality that, at least from an environmental perspective, there are times when the best thing we can buy is nothing at all?
Right. And that's you know, one of my... With ethnographic research, one of the conventions is to not use the actual names of the people you're interviewing so that they have more freedom to talk about issues openly. And that is a decision I made. Joe is the one exception to that decision. So one of the leaders of the fair trade movement, he actually founded one of the biggest coffee importers in the United States, fair trade or even non-fair trade. He constantly expressed his uncomfortableness over that issue. So he wants people to buy more coffee because he wants to help these coffee farmers, but at the same time, he's really concerned about global warming. He's also really concerned about the images of the coffee farmers in these advertisements. Oftentimes, the farmers are smiling and looking happy, and, you know, if you buy my coffee, you know, you'll change my life. And that's not exactly what's happening on the ground. I'm not trying to disparage the benefits that do go to coffee farmers and artisans, that they are vitally important. But it's not lifting people out of poverty. So you're exactly right. There is this tension of, you know, we can't shop our way out of some of these social problems, global warming probably being the most obvious. I'm thinking of a book by Barbara Kingsolver. It was a bestseller. She wrote this book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, where she raises her family on only locally grown foods for a year. Mm-hmm. And I think she makes one exception, and that's for coffee. So it is weird how people will make earmark kind of these certain products and justify it as being okay to buy, even if it goes against their value system.
How does interest in fair trade buying habits track with social class and with peer influence?
With social class, the people that I was interviewing tended to be very highly educated. They tended to have incomes higher than average. But again, my research isn't generalizable. It's focusing on how people construct meaning in these purchases. If you look at the survey research that's out there and the marketing information for organizations like 10,000 Villages, they are targeting highly educated consumers. And one of the reasons that's so is highly educated consumers with disposable income are more likely to have traveled and thus more likely to care more about something like fair trade than those who are not. At the same time, there is this really exciting research coming out. The book will be out soon. Howard Kimmeldorf is the chair of the sociology department at the University of Michigan, and he's leading this research study in part of the study looks at working class communities. And he's looking, he's comparing two sets of socks. One is a set of socks that are sweatshop free, and the other is not sweatshop free, so presumably produced in poor working conditions. And over a period of time, he's changed the price of these socks to see how much more consumers are willing to pay. And what's really exciting about this research is it's looking, the research isn't final, but it's looking like even working-class consumers are willing to pay premiums for products that align with their values. So it's not just survey research. It's looking like some people, in some instances, are even willing to back up their ideals with their everyday purchases. And it was a majority of consumers willing to do that.
Well, it would be hard to pick the sweatshop socks, wouldn't it, for like a dime cheaper or whatever
right.
It would be?
You'd think so. You know, I think one of the values of this study is that he did do this in like a dollar store in a working class community. And the value being if these consumers who are shopping on a tight budget are willing to pay a little extra, it's a good sign. People talk about fair trade costing extra all the time. And sometimes that is the case. But when we're talking extra, if you break it down by cup, you're looking at maybe a penny or two a cup of coffee that's purchased at retail, you know, at a coffee shop. So it's really minimal. But again, that varies by product. Some products, the price is significantly more.
So Starbucks has come up a couple of times, and Starbucks seems to have done a good job at promoting itself as a corporation that is interested in fair trade. And yet, as you point out, the fair trade coffee they sell represents just a fraction of their overall volume.
It's a fraction. To be fair to Starbucks, it is a growing faction. I don't know the latest numbers. It's very hard to get them to reveal their numbers. They do certify within their own company that their coffee is produced socially responsibly. Now, at first, I thought this was a joke, and I still kind of do, because who's to trust that a company is saying the product is responsible? But I was once teaching a class at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was talking about fair trade, and one of the students raised his hand, and his family owned one of the largest lands of coffee in Nicaragua, and they sold primarily to Starbucks. And he talked about all the regulations that Starbucks requires, and it is an extensive handbook. You know, many people have seen this and talked about it, but it's not fair trade. You can't trust something like that like you can trust something that's certified by an independent organization like Fairtrade USA or the Fair Trade Labeling Organization.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Pam in Denton who says, not everyone can afford to travel to deprived countries to view poor people. We do try and consume as much fair trade and local. Price still matters to those of us who work 40 hours and still can't afford health insurance or even make it paycheck to paycheck. Please find a different way to talk about this. It's insulting to be referred to as not as diligent as the more fortunate members of society.
That's not at all what I meant. And if I came across that way, then I apologize to Pam. I think I think the reason highly educated and more wealthy consumers are targeted is because these tend to be for-profit companies, 10,000 Villages being one of the major exceptions. So I think that this is companies' decisions to target these populations. I think if we look at the research that's being done at the University of Michigan and a few other places, we'll see that there is huge potential for consumers like Pam, and hopefully we will see more organizations targeting these types of consumers because it's got great potential. And you're seeing places like Costco and Walmart enter and to begin selling fair trade products because they understand that people like Pam and other consumers do care about these issues. What I find in my research is that these international travel experiences just lead many people to commit to this movement more strongly than people who don't have the luxury of making a trip like this.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. And talk about Walmart for a minute, because you know, one interesting phenomenon you document here is the conventional wisdom about particular companies and retailers as either defenders or violators of ethical labor practices. For example, there are people who say avoid going to Walmart but don't hesitate to shop at Target. And as you've noticed, they do business typically in pretty similar ways.
If you look at the history of people's attempts to boycott certain products. In the 90s, it was, you know, Nike and the Gap. And each of these companies tended to be market leaders. Now, the people I interviewed, let me give you a sense of my interviewees, that they're all people who identify as socially conscious shoppers. So I'm not interviewing just anybody. I'm interviewing people who came into these fair trade shops. Once I'm talking to those people, they put a ton of heat and a ton of pressure on Walmart, but then they all shop at Target and they don't know anything about Target's purchasing patterns. Not only do they not know, they intentionally, or marketers will call this willful ignorance, they willfully ignore learning anything about Target because they have a feeling that Target might be almost the same as Walmart. Mm. They just don't want to know. And by not knowing, they can still feel good about their purchases. So I mentioned the history because if you look at Nike, yes, Nike in the 90s, their labor practices were especially bad. But many other companies were producing shoes in the same factories as Nike's with the same labor conditions, but they didn't face the stigma that Nike did. So in many ways, as long as we've got the Walmarts of the world, the Targets of the world will get a free pass, and we won't criticize these organizations as much.
You discovered that many fair trade buyers are actually reluctant to evangelize about the perceived morality of their choices to their friends and families. What holds them back from that?
One example, if you're giving a gift, people would tell me again and again, 10,000 Villages, for example, I don't know if it's the majority, but a very large percentage of the consumers who come into 10,000 Villages are buying gifts. And the context of a gift, many consumers told me, like, they didn't feel right saying, you need to shop here because it's a better place to shop. So instead, what they would do is 10,000 Villages often gives a little story or a narrative that comes with the product, and they would slip it into the product and into the gift in a spot where they hope the recipient would see it. So the story might say who made the product, how that family or that person would benefit from the purchase. But time and time again, I heard consumers and even people working. I volunteered in a 10,000 Villages during this project. You'd hear people really reluctant to kind of try to proselytize other people. And the more I looked into this issue, the more I found that this is something we're seeing among college students, where professors are having trouble getting students to say what others should or should not do. There's even research on activists saying that activists often are reluctant to introduce strong moral imperatives, like you need to do this, which sounds counterintuitive. It is something that the fair trade, it's especially problematic for the fair trade movement, because what makes these products unique is the moral imperative, right? That the only thing different between a fair trade coffee and a non-fair trade is that a little bit extra money is going to help farmers. So if nobody, if store owners are reluctant to tell their customers this, then you're losing the value added that fair trade is supposed to provide.
On the other hand, when people did extol the virtues of these products, very often they would convince themselves, whether accurately or not, that the quality was better, that the value was better, that somehow these products as consumer goods in and of themselves were inherently superior.
Yeah, very, very much so. One of the funny stories I had interviewing a woman in a very large 100-year-old home in one of the wealthiest areas of Philadelphia, and she's telling me that you know, she loves fair trade products, and as we're talking, her dog's barking and jumping up on my leg, and she starts talking about organics, and she said, you know, my dog is the biggest consumer of organics in the house. If he has a choice, he always chooses the organic dog food. I'm just thinking, you know, this dog's not doing taste tests of organic food. And the point being is what you're hinting at is that if people support fair trade, they believe it tastes better. If they dislike the idea of fair trade, they believe it tastes worse. Hmm. And there's really no correlation between quality and fair trade standards. So it's kind of a misinterpretation on people's parts, but you hear it all the time.
Keith R. Brown is with us. He's assistant professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University. His new book is called Buying Into Fair Trade: Culture, Morality, and Consumption. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Give us a call. Let us know if you buy fair trade goods or not and why. You can do that, and we will come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Keith R. Brown, who is assistant professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. His new book is called Buying Into Fair Trade: Culture, Morality, and Consumption. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Keith, we've touched on the differential in price, which may not be particularly higher for fair trade goods, in some cases maybe substantially higher. We haven't really talked about the investment of time in terms of educating oneself about which goods are produced fairly and sustainably, and then the time that it might take to sort of track these things down. Can you talk about what you learned about people's willingness to spend that time to find fair trade products?
I think this relates really nicely to Pam's comment earlier, in that people don't have time. I mean, we live in such a, people are working, people who are fortunate enough to have jobs are working long hours for oftentimes not the pay that they feel they deserve. And to look up the product's history of everything that you're buying, I mean, how many of us know the life history of the toothbrush that we have or the toothpaste? You know, who made that product? Where did it come from? Are those people getting a fair wage? It's incredibly time-consuming. And what fair trade is supposed to do is alleviate some of that stress for consumers, to give them a sense that this product was produced somewhat fairly. you know, the real hardcore advocates at the center of the movement are saying, you know, if we water down what fair trade means, then I do have to look up what even a fair trade company is doing in terms of their workers. It is a major issue for us as shoppers inside and outside of the fair trade movement. So fair trade's supposed to eliminate that investment in time, but it depends where you stand. I mean, some people think I've still got to look up these products, even if it's certified as fair trade.
And then there are questions about the markups on these products. We actually are doing an interview tomorrow on this show with a woman who spent a great deal of time in Afghanistan talking to a family who earns its entire year's wages from this carpet that is woven every year by the mom in the family. And she earns, you know, about $200 for a year of labor. And that same carpet will ultimately be sold in the U.S. or in Europe for, you know, thousands of dollars. And so the question is, even in cases where the producer is being paid more locally, the real money is being made by someone else, and fair trade buyers may not realize that.
Yeah, I would guess, but I don't know this, that fair trade buyers would know this a little bit better than non-fair trade buyers, but it's a major issue. I was just down in Nicaragua in May with some students, and we met up with a coffee farmer who originally sold his coffee to one of the founders of the fair trade movement. And he was starting to feel like that wasn't good enough, and that he, in order to really get more returns for his money, for his investment, for all the work he was putting into his farm, he needed to sell directly to buyers in the U.S., and in this case, buyers would be, you know, coffee shops. And we are seeing fair trade relationships kind of acting as a gateway to direct buying. Especially in coffee, and hopefully, I know 10,000 Villages even encourages this to happen, so they like to create relationships with artisans in places like you're mentioning for your program tomorrow, but they're also not hesitant to encourage people to leave their relationship with 10,000 Villages if they can get something better. We're seeing this a little bit in coffee. The positive is that many of these coffee farmers who sell very high-quality coffee are getting significantly more money, which is very important for them. The negative is they don't get the assurance, they often don't get the insurance of long-term contracts. So with fair trade, you might enter a contract where I'm going to buy your coffee for the next 5 years so you can start to plan your future. And you can imagine how important that is. Whereas, you know, this family in Afghanistan might be struggling to make sure that they're selling this carpet every year. And if there was a way for them to get their goods directly to consumers, I mean, they would make 2 to 3 times as much money or even more. So the Internet, other mission-driven entrepreneurs are out there, and you are seeing this slow shift toward direct buying, which is happening. It's exciting. It's a really exciting aspect of movements like fair trade.
Well, yeah, if we can make that happen, everybody wins, right? The end consumer might pay less, but the producer makes vastly more.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the goal of fair trade, to cut out the middlemen so that the producer was getting significantly more money. And that has happened, but it could always happen in a better way. You know, in order to test that a farm is fair trade, that costs money. You know, you've got to send inspectors out there. You've got to fill out paperwork. It's time intensive. It's bureaucratic at times. So if that money could go directly to producers, in some instances, that would be a big boon for producers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Skip in Dallas. Hi, Skip.
Hi, good afternoon. I have just 3 comments. One, I wonder if one of the reasons that they're having trouble evangelizing, the fair market folks or fair trade folks have trouble evangelizing, is that one reason is they did the Walmart Target dichotomy. Walmart's bad, Target is good. The second one is I wonder if we have gotten some type of fatigue from hearing about everybody is our neighbor, which is true, right? But can I keep track of all my neighbors globally? It's just I can see a fatigue setting in. And then lastly, have we lost the moral center, and who can tell what is right and what is wrong? I think those are three big items for a issue like this.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Skip. What do you think about all that, Keith?
I really love his second point. Let me briefly address the first two. In terms of Walmart bad, Target good, this isn't my stance. What I'm doing as a sociologist is the people that I'm interviewing almost all of them made this claim. So in terms of dealing with this problem of the moral center of what is right, you know, I totally understand Skip's question and concern, because how are you to, for instance, you know, I started to compare Target versus Walmart and then realized how hard it is to make that comparison, to get that data about workers around the United States and healthcare benefits, and it's not an easy quest. I love his point about fatigue and that everyone is my neighbor. The truth is, you know, if you look, we can go back a few generations. We all knew people who worked in factories, or we all knew farmers. And today, that's less likely to happen. In Philadelphia, I asked my students to tell how many people are know farmers, or how many people know working in factories, and very few people are raising their hand. And this is because so much has been exported. And our farming is done on very large farms instead of small family-owned farms. Not to say that that's right or that's wrong. It's to say that now, since our products are produced all over the world, it's impossible to know who's producing all of our products. And it is fatigue. It's tiring. What fair trade attempts to do is create a meaningful relationship between consumers and farmers. Or artisans. They might do that by sending many coffee shop owners are sent to Central America to live alongside farmers. Employees at 10,000 villages are sent to Vietnam and throughout Africa to see how their goods are made, to try to get people to know your neighbors. But I think Skip's right. In many ways, it's an impossible task. The attempt is there. That is a goal of fair trade, to create those relationships, which we've largely lost.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Benjamin on the line in Dallas. Hey, Benjamin.
Hi, thank you so much. I work with a lot of artists in Hanoi, and I found that the more effective marketing for fair trade is to be able to connect consumers here in Texas that buy the art with the artists in Vietnam, but still, as a single entrepreneur trying to make this work, I am a far way from profitable. Are there better ways to tap into this market? Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
It's a tough one. The most expensive but yet most meaningful way to create these connections between consumers and buyers is to have them have had that international experience, but it's not feasible, right? So you do have organizations like the Fair Trade Federation and Fair Trade USA who bring producers to the United States. And they go, depending on where I think Benjamin said he was located in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, if you can tap into these tours, it's a way to introduce your customers to people who produce handicrafts. So a lot of times when these tours are scheduled, they'll target local universities or colleges. But if he could tap into organizations like the Fair Trade Federation, that might be a useful resource for introducing his customers to firsthand get to meet people who are producing products like handicrafts. But it's a struggle. I mean, he wants to help these artisans, but at the same time, he's got to sell aesthetically products that his consumers want. And even though consumers want to change the world, they are just as likely to say, you know, I want to change the world, but I really want something that will match my sofa in my living room. And that's Benjamin's struggle, I suspect.
This is, of course, not a how-to book, but I know you've learned a great deal about the subject. What would you recommend to people who want to know where their things come from and whether they are sustainably produced? And should people start by focusing, say, on food or on the clothing they buy? Is it easier to sort of ease one's way into a fair trade supportive lifestyle?
With the recent tragedies in Bangladesh with over 1,100 factory workers dying, you get this moment where you get raised attention to how some of the things we're buying are produced, and that's, you know, if there's any silver lining, you hope it's you know, changing the factories in Bangladesh and elsewhere. But at the same time, this story can sometimes be overwhelming because we looked 10 years ago in Central America and in many coffee-growing regions, thousands of people were dying of starvation and malnutrition because of this coffee crisis. The price of coffee reached a 100-year low. Tens of thousands of people were migrating throughout Central America to find work. It was a very horrendous situation. And I say it because, we hope that Bangladesh revives kind of consumer activism. But at the same time, we've got from chocolate to coffee, so many of the products we buy, we don't have major visible atrocities, or tragedies happening. But if we look at what's going on the ground, you see very poor living conditions. This is a social problem, but in many ways it's an invisible social problem until we get these moments like in Bangladesh. So if consumers want to learn more, it's a long process. There's no, you can't go to one website and figure all this out. But you can start with coffee, or you could start with going into a 10,000 villages where you can find a ton of information about these types of issues. And then hopefully that'll be the gateway drug into caring about your toothbrush.
Do you think we're making progress toward that?
Yes, slowly, but it's happening. I mean, major corporations are cause-related marketing really started in 1983 with this movement to help the Statue of Liberty by American Express. And today, cause-related marketing, you can get degrees in cause-related marketing. And if you look at the premiums that just from the United States in the last 12 years, we've had over $37 million increase. In 2000, we raised about $200,000 that went to coffee farmers. In 2012, just through fair trade purchases, we've contributed over $37 million to producers around the world. So this market's growing exponentially. Within coffee, it's the fastest growing segment of the market.
Keith R. Brown is Assistant Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University and author of Buying Into Fair Trade, Culture, Morality, and Consumption. Keith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.